That's good, Duncan said. I like the status quo very much, and I'm glad you do, too. It benefits all of us. No reason why we can't all get along. He got up, leaving the bag of peas on the table, a little meltwater beating on the wax. He said, You three stay here. My boys will look after you. Don't attempt to leave the house, and don't attempt to use the phone. Don't even answer it. The phone tree is off limits tonight. You're out of the loop. Punishments for noncompliance will be swift and severe. Then Duncan put his parka on, awkwardly, leading with his left hand, and he stepped past the guy with the Remington and headed for the front door. The others heard it open and close, and a minute later they heard the Mazda drive away, the sound of its exhaust ripping the night air behind it. Mahmani's man drove the Cadillac south on the two-lane, 5 gentle miles, and then he turned the lights off and slowed to a walk. The big engine whispered and the soft tires rustled over the pavement. He saw the 3 old houses on his right. There was a light burning in one of the downstairs windows. Beyond that, there were no signs of life. There were 3 vehicles parked out front, vague, moonlit shapes, all of them old, all of them rustic and utilitarian pickup trucks, none of them a new blue Chevrolet. But the Chevrolet would come. Mahmani's man was absolutely sure of that. Half of Rossi's attention was fixed on leapfrogging Saphir and Mahmani himself, which meant the other half was fixed on securing his rear. His relationship with the Duncans had to be protected, which meant his boys would be checking in with them often, calming them, stroking them, reassuring them, and above all, making sure no one else was getting close to them. Standard, common-sense precautions, straight out of the textbook. Mahmani's man rolled past the end of the Duncan's driveway and U-turned and parked 100 yards south on the opposite shoulder, half on the blacktop, half on the dirt, his lights off, the big black car nestled in a slight natural dip, about as invisible as it was possible to get without a camouflage net. There would be a dull moonlit glow from some of the chrome, he figured, but there was mist in the air. And anyway, Rossi's boys would be looking at the mouth of the driveway ahead of their turn, not at anything else. Drivers always did that. Human nature. Steering a car was as much a mental as a physical process. Heads turned, eyes sought their target, and the hands followed automatically. Mahmani's man waited. He was facing north, because on balance he expected Rossi's boys to come from the north. But it was always possible they would come from the south, so he adjusted his mirror to get a view in that direction. The mist that was helping to hide him was fogging his rear window a little. Nothing serious, but an approaching car with its lights off might be difficult to see. But then, why would Rossi's boys be driving with their lights off? They were 3 for 3 on the night and therefore probably very confident. 5 miles north, the orange glow of the gasoline fire was still visible, but it was dying down a little. Nothing burns forever. Above the glow, the moon was smudged with smoke. Apart from that, the nighttime landscape lay dark and quiet and still and uneventful, like it must have done for a century or more. Mahmani's man stared at the road ahead and saw nothing. He waited. Then he saw something. Way ahead, and off to his left, he saw a blue glow in the mist, a high, round bubble of light moving fast from west to east, a car coming in at him at a right angle, aiming to hit the 2-lane a mile or 2 north of him, aiming to turn either left and away from him or right and toward him. He took his gun from his pocket and laid it on the passenger seat next to him. The moving bubble of light slowed and stopped and started again and flared bright. The car had turned right, toward him. Immediately, he knew it was not the Chevrolet. The way the light moved told him it was too small, too low, too nimble. Porsches and Ferraris in Vegas moved the same way at night, their front ends rigidly connected to the pavement, their headlights jittering and hopping. Big, dumb, domestic sedans looked anesthetized in comparison. They moved like lumps, swaying, dull and damped and padded and disconnected. He watched and waited. And he saw the bubble of light resolve itself into twin nervous beams and then twin oval shapes close together and low to the ground. He saw the car slow 200 yards away, and then he saw it turn 100 yards away, straight into the mouth of the driveway. It was the tiny red Mazda Miata he had seen parked at the restored Duncan farmhouse, the daughter-in-law's car. She was visiting. Not a social occasion, presumably. Not so late at night. She had called ahead on the phone, probably. She had reported the encounter with the strange Iranian man, and she had been told to come on in for safety's sake. Probably the Duncans knew certain things were due to be settled before dawn, and they didn't want one of their own caught in a crossfire. Mahmani's man watched the Mazda bump and bounce down the driveway. He watched it park alongside the old pickup trucks. He saw its lights go off. 10 seconds later, he saw a doorway flare bright in the distance as a figure went inside, and then the scene went dark again. Mahmani's man watched the road and waited. The night mist was getting worse. It was becoming a problem. The Cadillac's windshield was going opaque. He fumbled around and found the wiper stalk and flicked the blades, right, left, right, left, and cleared it, which made the rear screen all the worse in comparison. It was completely dewed over. Even a car with its headlights on would be hard to recognize. Its light would be atomized into a million separate shards, into a single blinding mess, worse than useless. Mahmani's man kept one eye on the road ahead and groped around for the rear defogger button. It was hard to find. With the lights off outside, the dash and all the consoles were unlit inside, and there were a lot of buttons. It was a luxury car, fully equipped. He ducked his head and found a button with zigzag symbols on it. It looked like something to do with heating, and it had a red warning lens laid into it. He pressed it and waited. Nothing happened to the rear window, but his ass got hot. It was the seat warmer, not the defogger. He turned it off and found another button, one eye on the console, one eye on the road ahead. He pressed the button. The radio came on, very loud. He shut it down in a hurry and tried again, another button close by, a satisfying tactile click under his fingertip. The trunk lid clunked and popped and raised itself up slowly and smoothly, damped and hydraulic, all the way open, completely vertical. Now he had no view at all out the back. Not good. And presumably there was a courtesy light in the trunk. In reality, quite weak and yellow, but no doubt looking like a million-watt searchlight in the dark of the night. Not good at all. He pressed the button again, not really thinking. Afterward, he realized he had half expected the trunk lid to close again, slowly and obediently, like the seat warmer, and the radio had gone off again. But of course the trunk lid didn't close again. The release mechanism merely clicked and whirred one more time, and the trunk lid stayed exactly where it was, wide open, blocking his view. He was going to have to get out and close it by hand.